Take care of that and go away.
We're not gonna.
Good evening, everybody. We're having a little microphone hum here.
Well, you can take it off because
if it gets worse.
It's okay now,
isn't it? I think so.
Turn it off.
Yeah, that's why I took it off.
There's some kind of radio interference with something else.
I hope you can hear me then. Okay. Hello. Tonight I am going to talk about the third precept, the third grave precept, which is do not misuse sexuality. Remain faithful in relationships. So reading up on this precept, I came across Zen teacher Lynn Jensen in Tricycle Magazine. His article, Fall an Ear to the Ground. I also read Diane Ishin Rossetto, who we all know and love, and another authority on the precepts, Zen Buddhist precepts and ethics, is Robert Aiken in The Mind of Clover. So those are my sources. So I'm going to cover four general areas about sexuality in Zen. First is the ethics in Zen. Next is self-inquiry. The third is sexual tension. And finally, boorish sex. You know, as in boor. And that's a term that Robert Aiken has coined. So Zen Buddhist ethics, traditional ethics imply that conduct is based on a reference to fixed principles. But Zen teacher Lynn Jensen maintains that this approach is limited because any fixed ethical principle is a generalization, while events that we come across in our lives are specific. A precept such as do not kill, do not steal, do not lie applies to a respective category of human behavior. Since an actual event isn't a category, ethical precepts serve us best not as an immediate rule of behavior, but as an instrument of inquiry. Daishin Morgan of the Soto Zen Order of Buddhist Contemplatives taught that the purpose of the precepts is to guide, quote, guide us beyond their form in a legalistic sense to the spirit that lies behind them. The precepts are something to live with rather than live by. And living with the Zen precepts is ultimately humbling, softening our hearts to accept our own imperfections, and deepening our resolve to live without harm. I'm guessing most people who have studied their particular precept has sort of come across that. It's a very humbling experience. An ethical precept is a question to be held up to the light of circumstance, an inquiry rather than an answer. And the nature of this inquiry is not so much trying to figure out the right thing to do as an offering of an open heart. It's from this heart of ours that the precepts themselves once arose. At the threshold of choice, the Zen Buddhist trusts this ancient heart above all other authority, also known as the source. The Zen Buddhist doesn't reinvent the ethical wheel every time he faces a new situation, It's just that he goes back to the source itself. Ethics is not an invention, but an expression of the heart's core. What's most needed in the moment of choice is an empty hand. The person of right or wrong, for whom right is always right and wrong is always wrong, never risks an open hand. The Zen ethics is grounded in the realization that one does not know what's right. This not knowing is a refuge from which all moral action originates. It's a refuge that can't be relegated to the role of moral abstraction and remains a free and alive expression of the moment. What's offered us in the place of moral certainty is doubt and love, which are nearly synonymous. According to Jensen, doubt wears the hard edges off our best ideas and exposes us to the world as it is. When the great Zen master Ikkyu from the 1300s was asked, "What is Zen?" he replied, "Attention, attention, attention. Look at what is right there, right now." What else is moral action if it isn't compassionate responses? We don't get love from principles. We get love from occupying the ground we stand on. There are no signposts on the ground we stand on. Rather, we must keep an ear to the ground and listen to what's happening in the moment. The old Zen masters warned against becoming a person of right and wrong. This isn't that the masters were indifferent to the question of ethics. But for them, ethical conduct went beyond simply taking the prescribed right side. For these masters, the source of ethical conduct is found in the way things are, circumstance itself. Unfiltered, immediate reality reveals what is needed. Now I'll move on to Diane Ashin Rizzetto's remarks about this. And hers I'm calling self-inquiry. She reminds us that sex is one of the most powerful energies that we can experience as human beings, and one that perhaps we experience the most confusion about. So it's not surprising that cautions around sexual behavior have been stressed for anyone who hopes to cultivate a clear mind. She maintains that we need to look at it directly and know it intimately. There is no doubt that engaging in sexual energy out of greed, manipulation, anger, or power can result in suffering that ripples beyond the immediate people involved, families, children, whatever. This could be considered what Robert Aiken calls boorish sex. And there is no doubt that engaging in sexual energy with honesty, sensitivity, and an open and giving heart can be a vehicle for deep intimacy. The power and usefulness of working with this precept is not simply trying to determine correct behavior or valid taboos, but in inquiring deeply into the ways we use this powerful energy, which has the capacity to break down all barriers, to solidify and reinforce our individual safety zones. If we're sexually active, our powerful sexual energy can make it hard to slow down enough to consider and observe. If we're sexually inactive, we may think that this precept doesn't even pertain to us. Not so. Sexual references are everywhere these days, including the idea that natural aging diminishes us. I'm dealing with that myself as I age, and aging can diminish us, making us less desirable. And we can become obsessed about prolonging our youth through sex, and beauty and all those things. Modern discourse involves open discussions about suffering caused by sexual violence, like rape, incest, sexual abuse, and harassment, all examples of boorish sex. And it's out there. People are talking about it in the news. You know, it's in the air. We're also learning as a society to acknowledge the deep love and intimacy that can take place between non-heterosexual partners. True intimacy means standing openly with ourselves and others. Misusing intimacy. Misusing intimacy, especially sexual intimacy, relates to the ways we may separate ourselves from others, thus avoiding being fully and absolutely present. A precept that can help us, the precept can help us understand this perceived separation very deeply by revealing ingrained patterns of thinking and feeling related to sexual intimacy. Do we involve ourselves in superficial multiple relationships or move from one partner to another as a way to use sex as an escape from feelings of being alone and unwanted? We may use sex as a distraction to avoid or numb feelings and never come to really know what it is we're really trying to escape. Rosetto states that one of the most common misuses of sexual intimacy arises out of loneliness. We may avoid sexual attachments for fear of rejection or in order to perpetuate our feelings of worthlessness. Embracing sexual energy. Or we can use this precept to take an honest look at what is going on. Even if you have chosen a form of celibacy, depending on your particular libido, you may experience sexual energy nevertheless. The point is that you explore with openness the ways sexual desire weaves its way through the labyrinth of daily existence. Whether we choose abstinence, celibacy, or sexual engagement, we can learn something by really inquiring into it. Now, sexual tension. In traditional Japanese Zen monasteries, only men are admitted, and women train in separate quarters. Separate monasteries. And this avoids any distractions from sexual differences. The Japanese educational system experience, I believe, is also like this. I could be wrong. Dennis could correct me, I'm sure. But in general, I think that's sort of the posture in Japan. However, US Zen centers are integrated male and female. And Robert Aiken Roshi believes such proximity is beneficial to the practice and that this is most apparent during session, as those of us who went to our recent session will attest, because we're together all the time for days on end. He says, there is an experience of wholeness in having the other sex in close association throughout the day. Fantasies about sex are still inevitably present, but surely are less fierce than they might be if there were no chance to experience the humanity of the other in the give and take of cooking, gardening, and re-roofing together. His term. In this dimension, one is better able to accept the thoughts as normal and natural and permit them to pass. People in combination produce tensions in coeducational or celibate communities alike. And tensions can be used creatively, or one can be used by them. We can acknowledge sexual energy as part of a Sangha treasure. We can't justify rejecting sex, accepting the other human, and accepting the other human drives and emotions such as anger, fear, hunger, and the need for sleep. Sexual energy is part of that human need. Quote, all we have learned on our cushions proves that physical and mental conditions, the will and emotions, are human elements to be integrated into our daily life practice and our Zazen practice. For all its power, sex is just another human drive. If we avoid it just because it is more difficult to integrate than anger or fear, then we are simply saying that when the chips are down, we can't follow our own practice. This is dishonest and unhealthy, says Robert Aiken Roshi. Buddha nature is, in fact, the essence and quality of energy, including the human energy of sex. Bodhidharma said, self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the ungilded Dharma, not creating a veneer of attachment is called the precept of not misusing sex. Dogen Zenji said, the three wheels are pure and clear. When you have nothing to desire, you follow the way of all Buddhas, the giver, receiver, and gift. The actor, the one acted upon, and the action. Those are a lot of areas. Ethics and Zen, self-inquiry, and sexual tension. I'd like to take a break now and move into breakout rooms. And as I mentioned to Mick, I'd like to divide people into men and women, male and female groups. We only have one male here.
It's got to be mixed in the Zendo. And anyone in the cloud, I'm not sure the most politic way to say it, but if it's not obvious which group you would feel most comfortable in, then please message Mick. He will be making the breakout rooms.
Yeah, that sounds great. I was going to ask a similar question, but how about that?
All right.
How long do you want, Shuketsu?
Just about 10 minutes, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 8:24. And then I'll pose the question when you're all... Well, I'll tell you the question now. If you're willing, how does the third precept, do not misuse sexuality, remain faithful in relationships, come up in your life, given what we've just talked about? So if you're willing to talk about it, do so in group, and group of people of your own gender. And we'll come back in 10 minutes.
Shuketsu, I think the microphone is off for you. We can't hear you.
Right.
Oh, perfect.
Can everybody hear me now? I was just wondering what everybody talked about. Does anybody want to let me know in general, or let us know without disclosing, you know, secrets of people told, but. Anybody talk about ethics, the ethical, you know, precept, whether it's really the circumstance in the moment or self-inquiry?
Take the chair. Just take the chair.
Oh, good. We have somebody.
Right. I just want to make you do it.
Oh, thank you.
We basically talked about what it was is like in the different eras.
Yeah, that's what I sort of overheard.
Part so of that, I was in the 60s and right. 70s, and the rest of the group is suffering. Okay. But we did bring up AIDS, you know, and how that sort changed things for everyone. Suddenly, it's a brick wall.
Well, that certainly created tensions and sexual tensions. Anybody else? Any other groups want to speak up?
I'd say something. No. About what everybody else said.
Got a couple people. Go ahead.
You know, we got started on the whole cultural thing mm-hmm. around taking care of ourselves for health reasons, and then that blurring the line to taking care of ourselves for reasons of, you know, beauty and so forth. And some of us come from a background where you need to do that. It's important for you to look a certain way when you leave the house. And others did not. Mm-hmm. In our little group of four. But one thing that was very interesting for me that came at the very end was the difference where the precept came in, at least for me, is doing what I talked about for reasons of health, or for reasons because my mother told me to do this, or for reasons because I really do think I look better if I do this, mm-hmm. and my intention. It's my intention that gets me closer to how the precept comes up in my daily life, which I think was the original question. Mm-hmm. That's about as far as I can take it, but that connection was very helpful to me.
Thank you. Tyler?
One of the things that really struck me about this is we talked a little bit like self-reflection in our relationships. And so my partner and I, we are together, but we have some friends who are polyamorous, and they've been in a relationship together for a long time, and they have this agreement and they have this relationship. And, you know, we've known them for a while and throughout this, and my partner and I have talked about it, and it's not something we're interested in. But what it led me to really reflect upon in this is how my feelings of if my partner were off having a relationship with someone else, issues of like questions of jealousy, feelings of control, feelings of ownership, you know, all these sorts of things, like why, how would I feel if we were in that situation, if she wanted to have a relationship that was more open, and then just the self-reflection on what that means, like with how sex and sexuality, how that plays in our relationship, and my internal feelings of control or attachment or whatever that is, why I would be opposed to it.
Safety.
Yeah, it's safety, or it's and all sorts of other sorts of things. So it was that was self-reflection as that kind of came up in our conversation a little bit.
Thank you for sharing. How about Nick? I mean Mick. I don't know why I call you Nick. Mick.
This is a really tricky one to talk about, and I think that one of the things that I think that I like about this precept is sort of in our kind of like Judeo-Christian culture and background, you know, sex and sin are really strongly associated with each other. And so it's really hard to kind of like figure out a sort of like positive and loving way to embrace sexuality, in particular if yours is like a non-traditional sexuality. And so, you know, I like that this precept is not necessarily about like celibacy or abstinence. It's about embracing the way that you feel in the relationships that you have with others. And I think it's when I first like read it, I thought the word misuse was a cop out, because like in the definition of misuse, there's the precept that you're breaking. But I really do think that it's sort of a call to introspection, like you had mentioned before, of like, is this a way of honoring how I feel and whatever partner that I'm sharing this with? And so I really like that it has a much more kind of like, it feels like of all the precepts, it's the one that's doing me the work of like re-engaging with myself instead of trying to shut things off.
That's right. It's a very personal and individual thing. I know I've been avoiding it for years, talking about it. That's why I chose it, because I really wanted to dig into it. Chris?
My comment was similar to kind of builds off of what Mick was saying, in that coming from our, like my personal cultural background, I work and working with this as a precept, I like the fact that it's, with all the precepts, it's spun in this positive sense, because coming from a Judeo-Christian background in American culture, despite the fact that, you know, like you said, sex is kind of everywhere and commodified in our culture, it is associated with sin and in other religions, and shame, and kind of the guidance is more restrictive and prescriptive, and but having it framed up in this way that's positive, it kind of speaks to the Buddhist principle of self-awareness, self-investigation, and validating beliefs and teachings through your own practices versus just having something that's prescribed to you. And in the way it comes up for me is there are times when I feel very much in that space, and I feel like that type of relationship with or that type of experience of my relationships, but then it's very easy to default back into that background and to get caught up in all of those other things, and sort of seamlessly and without necessarily being where it takes the practice to keep up with making that change.
Yeah. Go beyond the ingrained thinking that you sort of grew up with.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of ingrained things that have been ingrained in us, as a woman who is married, we would think that this doesn't come up in every day, but being married doesn't stop me from wanting to be attractive, sexually attracted, mm-hmm. attracted to everybody. And it's just been ingrained. Girls are sexualized in this culture at such a young age, mm-hmm. through Barbies and, you know, is the princess beautiful? Like, oh, you're so, when you meet someone, when they are like, oh, what a pretty little girl you are. Like it starts from day one. And I think that's misusing sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, treating children in a way and bringing them up in a world where that they're not going to have to deal with this for the rest of their life. I mean, it's hard because of television, cartoons, and all these weird ways that we put this impression on children. But, you know, I'm living with that today. I can't.
Me too.
I can't. Just like, it's part of our culture now. And like Junior was saying, you know, like health, I'm constantly reminding myself that the pursuit of health does not equal the pursuit of thinness. And yet it's just, it cannot forget it. It's just an everyday thing for me.
I wonder if this is off sort of, but if that has anything to do with children now who are coming up and deciding they want to be non-binary, you know, all that stuff they're rejecting and all that. That's not the topic tonight, but it just, it begs that question. Heck with that nonsense.
Right.
So it's kind of good. Okay, I have a little bit more I wanted to talk about.
Sorry. Your talk is so good. Thank you. And
not quite done.
Normally, we don't associate ethics with sexuality, but we have this domination, this advertising, not just in our country, but throughout all of our commercialism in the way we live, modern man. So, and sex is just a big money ticket in many, many ways. Sorry.
No, you're right. It sells. They've been saying sex sells for a long time. The last topic I wanted to talk about was boorish sex that Robert Aiken coined that term. And it's about Zen teachers and students. And the role of a Zen teacher is to build a solid road of example and zazen that will link the wisdom that our ancestors offered to the pressures of ordinary living. Teacher's role is that. And when a sangha is disrupted by an affair between a teacher and a student, sex is clearly being misused. And Roshi Robert Aiken calls this boorish sex. He goes on to say, teacher's role is to teach, just as the function of a father or mother is to parent and a psychologist to counsel. The teacher of religious practice holds an archetypal place in a student's psyche. And he or she continues to teach in their dreams. It can get that intense. The way we're set up is we meet with our teacher maybe a couple times a month. It's not like in a monastery where you meet very often, but still you can, it can get into your head. And this factor must be worked with in the teacher-student relations. It's important that the teacher be respectful and responsible for this power and encourage students to speak up when they think they're being used or misused. By the same token, the student must avoid blind allegiance, because that can happen. Teacher is a conveyor of a lot of good information and enlightenment even. So they have a very powerful role in our lives. So when a teacher in the role of a teacher confronts a student sexually, the archetype is violated and the student is deeply confused and disturbed. He says, this is law as irrevocable as the law of gravity. And it's proved in the suffering of earnest Zen students and their sanghas in recent past years in the United States, maybe the last 15, 20 years. There was a whole spate of them across the country. Some of you may remember. So that's another aspect of sexuality that I wanted to talk about. And finally, the precept, do not misuse sexuality, remain faithful in relationships. I came across Domio's personal interpretation of this precept. She suggested a number of years ago that we write out our own, rewrite it in our own words. And she wrote, do not use the power of sexual attraction merely for pleasure or for building and maintaining your sense of self. Negotiate the intricacies of human intimacy with care, respect, and honor. That's all. Thank you. And thank you, Domio.
Is that it?
For that translation. Yeah. Okay. I'll end there for tonight.
All right. So we're not talking during this sangha meeting.
We offer the merit this Sangha meeting to
all, so that they may be able
to. So all may be able to
change the truth.
Speak the truth. I'm sorry, I'm not good at remembering. I freeze on stage.
All Buddhas
throughout space and time. All honored ones,
Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Mama, Prajna, Paramita.
Thank you.